Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a program of conversation and readings with local and regional writers. Now, here's your host, Nancy Wigman.
One of Comedy Central's 100 best comics of all time is Paula Poundstone. She's a popular panelist on NPR's weekly news quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. She tours regularly performing stand-up comedy throughout the country, including a visit to Chico's Laxon Auditorium on September 21st. Paula Poundstone was the first woman to ever host the White House Correspondents' Dinner. She's had numerous HBO specials and has won an American Comedy Award for Best Female Stand-Up. She has found time to write two books, There's Nothing in This Book That I Meant to Say, and her latest, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Paula Poundstone brings her improvisational humor to Laxon Auditorium in Chico on Friday, February 21st. Paula Poundstone, welcome.
Thank you.
I know you're primarily a stand-up comedian, but you're also an author. And I talked to you when you wrote your previous book, There's Nothing in This Book That I Meant to Say. And I really enjoyed your latest book.
Well, thank you.
The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. You say it's unscientific, but your chapters are labeled as experiments.
Yeah, I just know that, you know, if you really were a scientist, you might find some flaws in my method. but yes, every chapter is written as an experiment with the hypothesis and the conditions and the variables and the qualitative and quantitative observations, etc. But the real question for me in each experiment was trying to figure out what would make me happy, an experiment with to see if doing something would make me happy. And it wasn't about whether or not I would enjoy the thing, because I had a handle on what I enjoy. The question was, what could I do that would leave me sort of, you know, with a bounce, so that when I return to my regular life of raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day, that there was, you know, that I had some gas in the tank still, so to speak.
Well,
so the analysis part of each chapter is where I check back in with my regular life and see where it's going.
You know, this seems such an obvious question, but I don't think people ask themselves that. What really makes me happy? And you post this question, and you are not in any hurry doing your experiments. You took 7 years to write this book.
It did take 7 years, yeah. Some of them, like, for example, the Get Fit experiment, which is the first one, that went along with 7 months. as I vaguely suspected, by the way, I mean, not that just losing weight was the issue, although I certainly was pleased about that part. But as I vaguely suspected, which is when I stopped doing the Get Fit experiment, went on to something else, the 12 pounds I had lost came back, and they brought their friends. But it's not necessarily just about losing weight anyways, although, as I said, that, you know, that's nice icing on the cake. It's, you know, there's a good thing for the brain in physical exercise. I wish it wasn't so. Honestly, I was hoping the answer would be sitting in a chair eating Doritos. I really was pulling for that answer, but I don't think that is. It may be fairly pleasurable in the moment, but in terms of, you know, an actual lasting biochemical feeling of happiness, sadly, that doesn't do it.
So that's the first experiment you tried. You said, well, I'll get fit.
And yep, the Get Fit experiment.
And so it wouldn't be your natural tendency, but you did find... Oh, and another thing that makes me think, well, gosh, why didn't somebody think of this before? And that is, how do you measure happiness? So how do you know if you're being successful?
There is no measurement for it. happiness is a very strange emotion in a way, because, as I say in the book, it has no shelf life. when I look at pictures of something I did that was a pleasurable time, all it does is make me pine for that time. Whereas if I think about something where, you know, something made me mad, I can get mad all over again. or if it's something that reminds me of, of something that was upsetting or sad, same thing. I can bring that emotion back in a heartbeat. But happiness doesn't work that way. I don't know why that is. But so, yes, I came up with a measure, which is, it may be a little vague, but it's when you get a burst of happiness, it is a hep of happiness, and you get four of those, and that's a baloo.
So let's repeat that, because people might not have understood. What did she say? A hep? H-E-P? Hep?
H-E-P, yeah.
And four of those, yeah, as in?
And four heps of happiness is a baloo.
As in cat?
I had a cat named Baloo, and she was, I named her that partly because of, yes, the movie Cat Baloo, but also because of Baloo Bear from The Jungle Book.
So you came up with a way of measuring this in your chapters. When you describe your experiment, you tell us whether that was one hep or several heps or a baloo. There weren't a lot of baloos, I think, Paula.
I guess maybe there weren't. I think that I think the thing about really like a lasting happiness, it's a little bit like a rain. If there's a tremendous, if it feels like there's a tremendous amount of it, well, really, it just sort of washes off. Whereas I think when you do it a baloo at a time, you know, it soaks in and builds up. Because I'm trying to think which one, created this sort of lasting sense the most. And exercising really does, it really does help a lot. Let's see. I did one that was a really, I wouldn't call it a failure because I did find out the answer. But boy, the answer is not electronics. Because when I came to the Get Wired experiment, I was not, we had a computer in the house, like a big kind, but I didn't use it. It was for the kids for school, blah, blah, blah. And it turns out, it's kind of interesting, even when I was doing the first edit on the book, it was funny because I hadn't read that chapter in a long, long time. And when I went to write about it, I realized, oh my gosh, you really can see, not intentionally, but you really can see, because I came to computers a little bit later than most people, and because I really was like an almost entirely clean slate when I started, and then I add in this, element of, I learned, I went out and bought a laptop so that somebody could teach me how to do it, because if you don't have, with a laptop, you can go door to door and beg for help, that's the virtue there. Whereas if you just have the big kind in your house, you have to lure someone into the house to help you, and that's Jeffrey Dahmer ruined that for everyone, I say. But what's interesting is within that chapter, I really did feel myself not only not being happy, but losing, my priorities, my ability to focus. When I went to rewrite it, the editor goes through, of course, and she circles words and crosses things out and gives her opinion. One of the things was like, it's not good to overuse words, but what's funny when we went back to it, the word tired and lonely in the original draft of the Get Wired chapter, it was every few words. And obviously I didn't leave it that way. I cleaned that up. But the truth is that's very telling. I think that these machines, these silly flat things, are causing us all to lose our focus and lose. It's ironic that they use the word connection all the time, because in fact I think they're making us not connected.
My guest is stand-up comedian Paula Poundstone. She has a new book, Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. And Paula will be here in Chico and Laxon Auditorium in Chico the 22nd of September. And this book that you have written was written on a computer, Paul, because your previous book, you didn't use a computer to write that book, did you?
No, I wrote it by hand. And I wrote three math workbooks with my high school math teacher. All of them I wrote by hand. I would give the pages to, to somebody to type for me. No. And I didn't even start using this. I mean, I forget at what point the Get Wired experiment is in the book.
It's the second one.
Oh, is it the second one?
Yeah.
Okay.
And then Get Wired.
Yeah, so that's about when I started. And the other thing is about the book, my editor didn't understand this. She kept saying to me, because the Get Fit experiment was pretty successful. I mean, I really did notice times in my life that weren't particularly happy times where I felt, maybe happy is not the right word, but, I felt like I could weather a storm. As a result of the Get Fit experiment, and so then I move on to the Get Wired experiment. So I stop working out with this guy that I went to, and so my editor kept saying to me, she goes, "But wait, the reader won't understand why if that made you happy, why you stopped doing it." And I kept saying, "For science, because you have to isolate the variables."
Mm-hmm.
But there was only two things for which I did not do that. And that was the Get Wired experiment, which is once I started, I continued using the Silly Stupid Computer. And the other one was towards the end of the book, there is the Get Up and Help experiment.
Oh, that was...
And I volunteered at a nursing home, among a couple of other things, but the majority of it is I volunteered at a nursing home. And that was, I started there for the purpose of writing a book almost 3 years ago, and I'm still there. Because I really just felt like a jerk saying, like, got what I need, see ya. So I probably had what I needed for the book within the first couple of months of being there, but it just didn't seem right to abandon them. And so... almost 3 years later, I'm still there, and still feels like a good thing to do.
I think it probably surprised you, because when you first went there, you really didn't know what to do, and when you proposed, well, I could read to these old people, I could talk to them, and the employees there didn't know quite what to do with you, I think. And so they really didn't. You had to kind of figure it out for yourself.
And you know what? Unless I was going to go there and if I say I played an instrument or something, which I don't, but say I did and I could say, I'll come in and I'll play music for you. But just sort of going, the way I do it is I go to two mornings a week for like a couple hours and I bring my dog with me and,
You still have two dogs?
Yeah, one of my dogs has died since I wrote that. I wrote the book, but like it used to be Ramona on Monday, Sirius on Wednesday, but now Sirius does 2 days a week. I bring the dog, and some of the people really like the dog, and I bring jigsaw puzzles, and I sit and do puzzles. But the truth is, what I can do with who has everything to do with who is there at the time. Because the cognitive abilities of the various people there vary wildly. So there could be somebody that, is healing from something, but they understand everything you say and can carry on a fine conversation. And there's other people that, like, one time I gave someone a dog treat to give to my dog, and it never even occurred to me that they would eat it. And even with the jigsaw puzzle, I can sit down with one person and do the jigsaw puzzle, and another person will try to eat the jigsaw puzzle. So it really depends who you're with, what you can do.
Well, and there was a lady who kept asking you each time you'd see her, "Are you Abigail?" And you would reply truthfully, no, I'm not Abigail. And you got instructions from the whoever was inviting you to come there. Well, just go along with it. And what happened when you went along and said, yeah, I'm Abigail?
Yeah, so one day she says to me, are you Abigail? After I'd been, I was told, you're exactly right. I was told, you know, just whatever. If she says you're Abigail, go ahead. Just tell her, yeah, you're Abigail. So one day I'm there with my dog, and she says, are you Abigail? And I say, yeah, I am. And she stood screaming at me. And apparently, she has for years had like some sort of vendetta towards Abigail. And it wasn't like a happy group. She starts yelling that apparently Abigail also had a dog, because she starts yelling to cut my dog's tail off. I mean, she was very upset with that. So the next time I went there, she says, you know, are you Abigail? I'm like, no, I am not.
Your skills of improvisation came in handy when you go there. You never know what you're going to be faced with.
Oh, they really do. One time I was there, and there was a woman that she's kind of severe. And part of it is because she doesn't hear well. And so because she doesn't hear, she also shouts. And she just, I don't know, she could be a little intimidating. And I got the sense that a lot of the staff there was intimidated by her. So I decide one day that it sort of depends who's in the activities room, what I can do and who I sit with and how long and blah, blah, blah. But so I decide one day that I'm going to sit down with this woman and make a connection. You know, that's a happy happiness right there. That's all I want to do is just make a connection. And so I sit out with her and we start talking, and she does begin to respond to me. And she says to me something at one point about, you know, my husband. And I said, oh, I'm not married. And she goes, well, then you're a prostitute. It shouts it really loud across the whole room, and without missing a beat, I go, not yet. I said, so far, I've been able to make ends meet, but I'm certainly not above it.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll have more questions for my guest, stand-up comedian Paula Poundstone, who will be in Lackson Auditorium in Chico on September 21st. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, stand-up comedian and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist, Paula Poundstone. And you didn't get any credit for raising three children, I guess.
No. No, you don't get credit for raising three children. Not from the children, either.
Well, I think that your daughter, the vegan, I guess Allie's still a vegan, would be.
She is. Yeah, she is, which I very much admire, by the way. That takes a tremendous amount of conviction. She does it for reasons of conscience. And, you know, I swing vegan when I can, you know, but the truth is, you know, if I'm in a, you know, I travel for my living, and if I'm in a, you know, a place where there's, you know, where there's not a lot of choices, I may end up with a pizza. And, of course, there's dairy in pizza, and that is not vegan. So I admire my daughter.
I bet she was pleased that what you say in the front of your book, when you say the experiments in this book were conducted over a period of 7 years, and then you add a note. You remember what you said?
Yeah, no dolphins were harmed in the making of this book.
Yeah.
It's true. Well, you know, we're in my house, we're all, well, people say to me all the time, you go, because I have 14 cats and then a German Shepherd dog. And in the course of my children's lifetime, we've had bunnies and lizards and more dogs. So people always say to me, well, you're an animal lover. I go, you know, when you have 14 cats, you're an animal haver.
Well,
you know, I don't know how much time there is for love. Because I am a charwoman to a house full of cats.
Well, you say that you distinguish yourself from you're not a crazy cat lady.
No, because I have a dog.
That's right.
See, if you only had cats, if you had 14 cats and nothing else, you might well be a crazy cat lady. But I have that, I have a dog. My dog is my beard, really.
So now you're an animal lover rather than a crazy cat lady. Well, it was funny that at the time you were writing the book, you actually had 16 cats. And some guy says, well, how did that happen? And what did you tell him?
I told him I had 15 and I got one more. That's how I get 16.
And that's how you get 16 cats.
Now I tell people, they say, how did you get 14? I say, I can tell you exactly how I got 14. I had 16 and two died. I'm helping America with math. That's what I'm doing.
My guest is stand-up comedian Paula Poundstone. She's also a regular panelist on NPR's weekly news quiz show, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. But she's written a book, The Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. And a lot of people are not very happy with the fact that their home is cluttered and disorganized. And so you had the idea, well, maybe that's how I can get happy. I'll get organized.
I'll tell you, the get organized experiment pretty much brought me to my knees. I think it's the climax of the book. It was just so damn hard to do. And in the beginning, I thought, you know, I'd heard about organizers before, the profession of an organizer. And I really didn't want to do that. I thought, you know, I'll just do it myself. I'll just dedicate myself to doing this. And by the fact that I'm doing it as part of my work, this will justify the time that I put into it. Because if I'm working, I give all sorts of space to what takes time for working. But, you know, for something that would give me any kind of happiness, that's very low on the schedule usually. I'll just do it myself. It was so overwhelming that I got writer's block as well. I could barely move forward because, for one thing, I had kids in school at that point. I had kids in like three different schools, I think, at that point. And, you know, the problem with getting organized is that everything gets darker before it gets lighter. So you have to sort of lay things out. You know, if you're cleaning out your closet or whatever, you know, you have to lay things out and then go over them. And by the time you've got everything out of the closet, it's time to bring snacks to some kid's school party or time to drive somebody to soccer or time to, you know. So it was very, very hard to do. And I did eventually crack and I got a professional organizer. And it was better. It was definitely better because, you know, they're heartless. They don't care about the picture your kid drew in preschool. They're just like, yeah, get that out of there. And it does feel better. It really does feel better to have less.
And you know what I thought was realistic too, Paula, that when she says, "What if you got this photo of your kid?" and you tell her a story of why you have this photograph. And you end up realizing, gosh, if I'm telling her stories, it's on her nickel. I mean, I'm paying her.
Oh, that's
for her
exactly
time.
Right. Yeah, we were doing my desk at one point, you know, and it just had 1,000 things on it, you know, and that was probably where we started or something. And I would, you know, I'd pick up a picture and then I'd end up telling her what the picture was and who was in it and what we were doing. And one day I realized, wait a minute, I'm paying this woman by the hour. And by the way, a lot of money by the hour. And after I figured that out, I'm like, okay, you know, I anything we pick up, I'm just going to say I don't even know who's in that photo. You know, because you have to become a little icy cold yourself, I think, to get through this process. And it's not like I'm I had a lot of stuff. It's not like I'm a hoarder per se. It's more that the time where you, the opportunity where you process whether or not you need or want that thing somehow doesn't come up in your daily life. And so things get put in boxes, you know, shoved under the bed, put in closets, and so you end up having to do this horrible process. And so the woman would do stuff like she would, We went through, you know, trunks of underwear that had started out like a thick, high-waisted cottony brief, and I'd worn it for so many years that now it was just a handful of strings. And instead of throwing it away, I'd always just shoved it back. It just sort of went behind the rotation of the other underwear. And she'd put it all out on the table. She would hold up each one and sort of dangle it in front of me. And I said it was very much like the House of Un-American Activities years ago, the Senate panel, when they were, you know, questioning the communists. every garment felt like it was on trial. And we really did lighten the load.
Well, and you're hiring a green organizer, and you first thought, oh, she's good for the environment. She's a green organizer.
Yeah, right. I figured she was, exactly. I thought she was, pro-Earth. But when I got her bill, I realized the green was the money I paid her. But I would say, you know, overall, yeah, and the problem with organizing is that it's not just a task like vacuuming or sweeping. You know, you go down this emotional journey with these things, and that part I hadn't anticipated.
Well, you mentioned she told you we only wear 20% of our clothes, and so that figure encouraged. Well, I better get rid of stuff, and I have to admit that the same thing that you did in your book, the reason you wore the pilgrim costume to...
Yes.
Wait, don't tell me.
She said you had to get rid of anything that hadn't worn in a year. So one day I go to work at... don't tell me. Where we tape in Chicago. And I show up. And it wasn't in the fall, by the way. I don't remember what it was. It might have been the spring.
It wasn't around Thanksgiving, in other words.
It was not around Thanksgiving, exactly. And I get there, and, I take my jacket off, so it must have been, like, cold weather. I take my jacket off, and underneath, I'm wearing a pilgrim costume. And Peter Sagal, my boss, was like, what? Why are you wearing a pilgrim costume? And I said, because I'm working with an organizer. And she says, if I haven't worn it within a year, I have to get rid of it. And so I'm wearing it so that it's gotten some use and I can justify holding on to it. And by the way, I still have my pilgrim costume.
Well, you do say, I loved having less clothing.
So yes.
The process
yes,
was
do.
Painful. But
I like having less things. The thing buildup is, when I was young, I could move in a cab. Mm. In some ways, I wouldn't mind going back to that. For example, I had this jewelry box. Had all this jewelry. Some stuff that if you saw it, you wouldn't believe it was mine. And I never, part of the reason I held on to it was because my daughter, Allie, when she was little, used to like to pull that box out and put the things on. And that was part of the reason I'd kept it all those years. But by the time I'm writing the book, you know, I don't remember the last time Allie went in my closet and tried my things on. Now she's 24, for heaven's sake. She doesn't do that. And I realized I had stopped wearing jewelry years ago. It takes too much time. I don't know that it really, I don't feel physically enhanced by it. And I just decided, you know, if I want to decorate something, I'll get a Christmas tree. I don't need stuff hanging off me. And so away that stuff went.
My guest is Paula Poundstone, and she has written a book, Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. And she describes hiring a green organizer to help her get organized. Now, one thing helpful, this organizer one day brings over these four collapsible boxes. And what does she want you to do?
Genius. Absolute genius. Just that little technique. Because when you do it by yourself, right, what do? You go get trash bags. Usually, you know, you've got a lot of stuff, and so you get the big, thick, green trash bags. And in order to tell which bag it is you're putting stuff in, because there's, right, the giveaway pile, there's the recycle pile, and there's the trash pile. And in order to tell which one you're putting it in, every single time you have to grab the opening of the bag and look inside to remind yourself which bag it is. And so this woman just has these four collapsible boxes, and you can see what you're putting in. You don't have to stop and open it to see. And I just thought, it just was such a brilliant idea. And I thought, you know, every therapist in the world should we all should use that idea in our own brains. You know, there's the stuff that, you know, there are the thoughts that you have that move you forward. And those should be in a collapsible box. And then, you know, there's the relationships you have that aren't helpful at all, and those should be in a different collapsible box. And there are the thoughts that are just, you know, unproductive, and why are you even wasting time with them? And those should be in another box. The collapsible box system is genius.
But that's easier said than done, then, when you're dealing with thoughts that are not productive to put them aside.
Honestly, isn't it? Yeah, it really is. You know, I am a very jealous person.
Oh, you think so?
I have no intention of being jealous. I recognize it as a very negative emotion. It's not my plan. But I got to say, in all honesty, I tend to feel... It's this thing of comparing yourself to someone, you know, and somehow you or I, anyways, always come up short. And so sometimes when I'm having a hard time writing, I keep thinking to myself, well, Charles Dickens didn't even have a ballpoint pen. He had, you know, he certainly didn't have a computer, but he had ink and he had to dip it in and write, and he wrote... I believe I'm right about this, that he would write for 2 weeks and then not for 2 weeks and then write for 2 weeks. And he was so prolific in all his students. And so when I go to write, I literally think to myself, why can't I do this? Look what Charles Dickens did. And every now and then I have to stop myself and go, am I really comparing myself to Charles Dickens? Did I really just think that? I actually reach back in history and find the great. I'm not just jealous of the person next door. I'm comparing myself to Charles Dickens and Abraham Lincoln.
Well, there was a chapter when I didn't feel it came across as jealousy, but more of maybe you felt like you were on a competitive basis with other dancers, and so you thought, gosh, I can't just walk into a beginning dance class. I better take some private lessons first.
Yes, I did, and I took them for a really long time, I think, as the scale of this book goes. And I took as many private lessons as I could. I was trying to learn to swing dance. And I wanted to learn to swing dance because I figured it would be a key to happiness, because there's movement, there's the music, and there's the social life. And that's a pretty good trifecta for the brain. And so I thought, this will do her. I felt really shy about going into a group class. I just thought, you know, I really should need a runway here, you know, to get up speed. So I booked as many private lessons as I could in the time that I had, and then eventually, I had my sort of debut where I was going to this group class, And I swear, anything. Well, the weird thing, well, two things happened. One thing is, I took private lessons with one dance teacher, and then I went to the group class with a different dance teacher. And it turns out what I learned with the first guy was not the same stuff they taught. Because I was hoping to go in there and ace it. I mean, I was really hoping that people would be like, ooh, boy, look at her. Isn't she amazing? Boy, you wouldn't expect that from Paula Poundstone. I was really hoping to blow the room away. There was a lot of, a lot of ego involved. That's not what happened at all. I was so bad I stopped taking group lessons. I went back. I took privately with the woman that I took group lessons with.
When you're scoring this experience, going to a dance and having to dance with some stranger and you rotate, and that scored very low on your happiness scale.
It really was nothing like what I thought it would be. It's true.
But
the humiliation of not being good at this. And, I mean, part of it was because perhaps my expectations were a little high. But, the humiliation of not being good at this and, in front of this group. They do use this really clever system, which I think is actually quite brilliant, which is when you go to the group swing dance class, I kept thinking that I had to. It said specifically on the advertisement that you didn't have to have a partner. But I thought, oh, my gosh, they're going to pair you up with somebody, and that's going to feel awful, too. And there were people that came as couples, and I'm like, damn it, see, you did have to have a partner. But that's not what they did. What they did was you form two circles, one big circle of people, maybe the women, say, for example, and then the guys or anybody who wants to learn to lead, the inside circle. So there's one big circle and one smaller circle within, and you rotate. They'll teach you one thing, one little teeny step, and you work on that for a few seconds, and then they go rotate, and next thing you know, there's another guy standing in front of you, and another guy standing in front of you, and another guy standing in front of you. It's really a very clever way to do it. What's good about it is that the embarrassment that you feel with the first person, you don't see them again for a while as they work their way around the circle.
We're going to take a break, and when we come back, I'll have more questions for my guest, stand-up comedian Paula Poundstone, who will be in Lackson Auditorium in Chico on September 21st. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, stand-up comedian and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me panelist, Paula Poundstone. So this was not necessarily high on your happiness scale, but when you would take the private classes, though, they did make you happy, no? When you would come out of a dance lesson with a private teacher?
Yeah, I have to say, the first one I took with this guy on 4th Street in Santa Monica, and there's a parking garage there, because parking is horrible in that area of town. So I have to go to this parking garage, and it was 9 floors up, the parking garage was. So I would, where I could finally get a space in the garage would be 9 floors up. And so I'd park on the top floor, on the 9th floor, and then I'd walk down the stairs, go do this dance lesson, and walk back up. And you know what? In retrospect, I'm not positive that it wasn't the exercise I got from the stairs that made me feel good.
So you weren't sure?
Because when I look back on the dance class itself, I don't know. And the other thing is, I was so bad. He couldn't use the upbeat fast music. He used like the blues. I do the Charleston, the Fire and Rain. It looks like Tai Chi when I do it.
So you couldn't separate out what was it that really made you happy? Was it the nine flights of stairs, or was it the actual dancing that you did?
Yeah, I'm not really certain, but I would tend to think, looking back, that it was it had a lot to do with just the exercise I got from walking up and down those stairs. Although I got to say, when I go, I did. I think the experiment finally culminates in this night where I go to the social dance.
Yes.
And it was grueling, really. But the one thing that was terrific about that social dance was the woman who puts this particular event together. Her name is Rusty Frank, and she takes like an Elks Lodge or something and makes it Rusty's Rhythm Club, you know, one night a week. And she does a fantastic job. And she hires live bands. And the music is fantastic. I could go and just sit and listen to the music, you know, and sip a diet soda and probably be pretty happy just like that.
Well, she also... I think she was the one that outlines dance etiquette, like you're over on the side and the leader comes over and takes your arm, takes you out on the dance floor. When he's done, he takes you back to where he left you off. But there were other little tips in there, too, that you might want to share, Paula.
You know, honestly, I've forgotten. There was a lot of personal hygiene stuff that she told everybody. You weren't supposed to be sweaty. There was a lot of it was funny because even when she told us that and in her class, you know, it's all these adults in a room in a dance class, but she gathers everyone over to the corner of the room as if we're avoiding someone else to tell us that you know you need to make sure that you don't smell bad when you're dancing with people. And this whole thing, okay, she says to us about the etiquette of, how you, as a woman, one of the fun things about swing dance is it's not all, if there's a woman that has learned how to lead, great, as another woman can go dance with her. And if there's a guy that's learned how to follow, terrific, a leader can go dance with him. So the sort of gender barriers, in small percentages, are falling away, which is nice. But she says, well, okay, so the leader comes and asks the follower to dance, basically. But it's usually the guy asking the woman to dance, and then he and so I'm thinking, so we practice this, and I swear I'm not making this up. I was the last person chosen. It was like every junior high fear you ever had. And I'm like, okay, this is not making me happy. I mean, I lived through it. The good thing is I probably got some grit out of it.
Well, because I've been to dance classes like what you describe, I know that your descriptions are accurate. That was my experience, the whole procedure. I know that was based on fact. But now sometimes comedians can exaggerate for effect. So your chapter on when you go around hugging people, Paul, you say you hugged a TSA agent in the airport. Really?
Oh, yeah, they don't like that.
But did you actually?
I'm now on the national do not hug list. I did this experiment where my original plan was to hug everybody I met for 24 hours. And I ended up really having to modify that because, first of all, the goal here is not happiness at the expense of others. That's not the goal. So I realized once I started, and it's a really tough cliff to jump off of. I realized, like, I can't just go up and grab people, for heaven's sakes. And so I modified it. I mean, I started the day in an airport, and I modified it to, some there were cases where I did hug strangers, and lots of them, actually. But mostly it was, handshaking, eye contact, some more contact than one would normally have. And it was interesting. It was fun to do. But I got to tell you now, because the book's been out for, I don't know, two year and a half, something like that. Now, I have had the experience of being in the airport and have someone come up to me and say, a woman said to me one day, she goes, I just finished reading the Warm and Fuzzy chapter, because that's what it was, the Get Warm and Fuzzy experiment. She said, I just finished reading the Get Warm and Fuzzy experiment, and I'm doing the experiment by myself. Can I hug you? And I was so delighted that she was enjoying reading the book, but B, that she decided to try the experiment, because you know what? That was fruitful. Yeah. It really was. There was the occasional guy that hugs with that sort of metal embossing embrace. I call it the defibrillator hug. For the most part, it was nice to make a very deliberate connection with people.
One of your observations is that hugging causes weight gain. That was a particular circumstance. Do you remember, Paulo, why you said
that? No, I can't remember. Why did I say that?
Well, it involved treats.
Sure it does.
Treats afterwards. And so they were giving, I think they were candies or something. So I don't think that's a general thing you can write down, that hugging causes weight gain. But it was pleasant. One time you were I think it was maybe a recording of Wait, Don't Tell Me. And afterwards, you were going to hug these people. And they were just so delighted, and you hugged people. And there was a kind of understanding of how long that hug would be. And then you're on your way to a reception. Your son happened to be accompanying you on this particular trip. And when you went to the reception, it was different, the hugging.
Yeah, what happened was, I was at this, we were at this theater, the Red Rocks Amphitheater in Colorado, and it was 8,500 people, audience members.
Yeah, I was shocked when you said
show.
That. 8,500 people in your audience.
It was for Wait, Don't Tell Me. It wasn't just to see me. But so when I went to leave, so I was supposed to go to this reception for the radio station right away. I wasn't supposed to stop and talk to audience members, but I can't help myself when someone asks. And so I come to the front of the stage, and I start talking to people, and then the next thing I know, there's this line of people, and so I start hugging them. I say, "Can I hug you?" And I must have, you get a rhythm that way. There's a little, each person sees the exchange of the person before them, and there's a pattern and a format. By the end of it, we were all pretty good at this. And now I go into this reception where we didn't have a rhythm, and that's where the really crazy hugs began, the really unskilled hugs, and one guy, I swear I'm not making this up. One guy had like some sort of little rabbit puppet. And after he hugged me, he holds up the rabbit puppet that I hadn't seen before that. And he says he pulled it out of my ear or something. And I just, it's not a good hug. You don't pull a rabbit out of somebody's ear when you're hugging them. That's not a good hug.
I just wanted to mention that I really enjoyed your book. And I also thought
that is nice to hear. Thank
your conclusions were really wonderful. I think people can, it's more than just, I laughed out loud, as you might suspect. I laughed out loud, but I think people will also learn something that they can apply to their own lives. We're looking forward to seeing you in Lackson Auditorium. In fact, we'll be looking forward to what you are wearing, since Peter Sagal of Wait, Don't Tell Me called you a fashion icon.
No, Peter didn't call me a fashion icon. He had a fashion expert was the Not My Job guest. Peter makes fun of how I dress. But the Not My Job guest guy, I forget who it was now, he's some big guy in the world of fashion. So Peter's making fun of me, and the guy goes, oh, no, Paula Poundstone is a fashion icon. I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm so glad that's been recorded.
Well, we look forward to seeing and hearing you, Paula Poundstone. Thank you for being my guest today. Paula's
book
is
so much fun.
Totally Unscientific Study of the Search for Human Happiness. Something you might not know about Paula Poundstone is that she loves libraries. She is a spokesperson for United for Libraries and supports Friends of the Library groups. You can support your local library by participating in the Trivia Bee for Literacy, which is coming up next month. The Butte County Trivia Bee is a fundraiser that supports Butte County's literacy program. North State Public Radio's new general manager, Phil Wilkie, is putting together a team for this October 26th event at the Sierra Nevada Big Room. And it's not too soon to sign up your own team by calling 530-538-7198. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, MyNSPR.org. I'm Nancy Wigman.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf. Our theme music is The Mysterious Barricades by Francois Couperin, performed by Warren Haskell. Nancy's Bookshelf is a production of North State Public Radio.